music you've just heard in the background was by Jake Bright. He's my son. He's a bass player and a double bass player. It's been a mad week. I've seemed to spend all my time in front of these damn computers in front of me, editing and editing and editing. So I thought I'd take 5 minutes out and have a chat to him about what it's like to be a young musician and what it's like to play with orchestras and what it's like to play on stage with bands again. Because it was such a long time for me, I don't actually remember what it was like. Anyway, let's see what he says. I'm interested to know what it's like to actually be at university studying music.
It's mainly intense and obviously on the side quite interesting as well.
How is it interesting?
Up to now, I've been studying music since I was about 11. And it's all been quite basic. It's like, here's the dates of the classical period, here's the dates of the Baroque period. But now we're sort of really getting into it, and like the political things, the religious connotations, all of that, whether or not Bach liked his coffee black or white, that sort of thing. So it's just nice to see composers, instead of them being these people who just did whatever it was they did, they're actually people. And they had personalities and they had lives, and we sort of got into that more. And from a composition point of view, everything just at some point just seems to click, and harmony makes a bit more sense now. I was never particularly good at it through A-levels, and I'll be honest, I'm not particularly great now, but it's sort of on the way to making sense. So everything's just a little less blurred and there's more of it.
So you're actually enjoying the performance side of it, or are you enjoying more of the sort of academic side of it?
The academic and the performance are quite separate at the moment, just because I'm not playing so much during term time with an orchestra.
So I mean, I know you play a lot in sort of bands. You've played London quite recently. You've done up and down the country. So you've been spending a lot of time in Bournemouth playing in CD clubs in Bournemouth. So I mean, and then also then playing with the North Devon Sinfonia. Yeah. In proper, if you like, concert venues. So, I mean, how does that sort of feel to do those two different things?
I guess there's a certain level of professionalism expected from both, but they're both quite different types of professionalism. Obviously, with the orchestra, you've got to turn up, you've got to look the part, you've got to just behave, basically. Whereas with the club band type thing, it's a bit more, well, it's exceptionally lenient, turn up late, whatever, you know, anything goes. So I suppose discipline are two of the things, but obviously you can't muck about too much because then you just don't get kicked.
It's always fascinated me sort of performing, and you know, when I used to do loads of stuff, is that the whole pressure of actually performing in clubs, in you know, specifically if it's a big venue, is the strain and the tension is actually trying to remember the songs. I mean, but when you're playing in an orchestra, you've actually got the notations down, and you've got a conductor who's telling you when to come in and when to not play. So how do you feel about that? What's the difference?
Again, the memory thing versus the music. There's a certain level in classical performance these days where you're expected to do stuff from memory, but that's usually sort of soloists and things. I think singers are almost always expected to do it from memory. So at that point, I suppose there's not too much of a difference. But with an orchestra, you've got quite a lot of things backing you up. You've obviously you've got the music in front of you, which sort of, well, tells you what you should be playing. The conductor's there. She knows where she is, well, usually. So you've got that security, and everybody's going off that one point, and if that one point goes wrong, everybody goes wrong. Which is kind of a nice thing, really, because at least then if it does go wrong, it's not your fault for a change. Whereas on stage...
Blame the conductor.
Basically, it's foolproof plan. On stage, obviously, with foldback and things, it's a very different environment. You've not got the brass blasting through your right ear, and you can't see the beat as well as hear it. And obviously, a lot of the time is so poorly mixed on stage, you can either hear the drums and the lead guitar, but not your own vocal. I can remember one gig, I was actually trying to play in time by watching the singer's lips and the drummer's stick hitting the snare, which was a nightmare. And obviously things can fall apart quite quickly in that environment, and that's not usually anybody's fault. It's just a series of unfortunate events.
So do you think the actual sort of the training, the classical training of being able to keep a tempo in your head and all that has actually helped playing in band situations?
Definitely, definitely. I mean, the sort of the discipline of the classical world, when you bring that into the rehearsal room with a band, it's just so valuable being able to just get in and have that discipline behind you, so you know where you should be and when, regardless of whether you're playing jazz, punk, pop, reggae, baroque, whatever, it all has a constant.
So do you think sort of creatively that both, you know, disciplines of, you know, of playing on the stage and doing things from memory and then being in an orchestra and having somebody there to sort of help you through the score, mm-hmm. do you think each one's complemented each discipline?
Almost certainly. Not only in performance but in rehearsal technique as well, without a doubt. With classical music, when we're rehearsing through what we're doing, I'm doing some Tchaikovsky at the moment, and it's quite, there's short passages of really intense, complex bits, and to get it right, you've just got to play it and play it and play it, and then the cellos and the violas will just play it together for a bit, then the flutes and the piccolos and the oboes or whatever, and then you throw it all together at the end, and eventually you just get this coherent thing. And a lot of bands these days, when they rehearse, they just go in and blitz through as many songs as they can in as short a space of time as possible. Which, having had the classical rehearsal thing drilled into me for so many years, seems insane. So you've got to walk in, and the drummer and the bass player, if they need to do that 20 minutes together, and the rhythm section need to talk to the guitarist and see what their job is in relation to him. It's
I mean, yeah. you play two instruments which are actually the same instrument. You play the double bass in the orchestra, and you play an electric bass sort of in for jazz,
yeah.
and other sorts of stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. So how different is that?
The angle, that's the main thing.
But the technique is exactly the same.
The technique, obviously, double bass, it's considerably larger. The tuning and everything is identical. Which is great. Less to remember, obviously. But I find that the double bass is much more refined because of that. You don't have the frets and the dots and the lines and everything to go by. It's very much it's almost a tactile way of playing as opposed to a visual thing. You sort of, once you've played with a particular instrument for long enough, you know that when you put your hand in the, you'll put your thumb in the join between the neck and the body, that if you put your third finger down, you'll get a G. Well, in theory.
So from what you're saying, you actually prefer the double bass to electric bass, then, really?
Yes and no. I find the electric bass is much easier to, you sort of run away with it. You can go off on one a bit more. I guess it's because I know my way around it a bit better, because you can it's just physically easier to play. It's not as strenuous. But the double bass, I think, can be much more subtle. Obviously, you throw the bow in there and you've got a completely new sound.
It's a different set of sounds altogether.
It's completely different.
Creatively then, so which do you think is the most inspiring for you? I presume it sounds as though it's the double bass again.
I guess I couldn't say, because I've always had them both.
Okay.
And I don't think I'd be able to lose one. To me, they sort of are part of that sound world, the lower end of things. I mean, when I'm writing or talking to Dan Wakefield about songs, I don't think, right, I've got to play this on electric bass. I think, what would happen if I threw in a bow or made myself sound like a cello and then dropped down and started plucking away down at the bottom end.
With sort of studio work and stuff, I mean, you've played bass for me, which has been fun, and you know, and you're a better bass player than I am, so, which is quite disappointing. But never mind.
Sorry,
it's okay. So when you've mentioned Dan Wakefield, who's the singer with a band called the Dastards. I mean, you've been playing with them for about 18 months, is it?
What's the date? Probably about that. Yeah.
has that been a learning curve?
I guess so. Actually, thinking about it, it's quite odd because I can remember when I was younger. Dan's sort of 3-4 years older than I am. He's 21, 22 now. Obviously, I'm only 18, and I can remember when I was about 12. The Dastards, as it isn't now, was probably just starting up then, and he came over to our place just with his dad, who's a family friend, and he brought his guitar with him, because obviously the sort of the 12, 15, 16 age gap is quite a big one, and so I didn't really talk to him, but remember him playing, and I thought, that's actually kind of what I would like to do in 3 or 4 years. And in a way, I guess he was sort of... he sort of planted a seed that I'd never really noticed, which was 18 months ago, sort of brought back, and I was fortunate enough to get involved firsthand, which was nice.
So, I mean, it was quite a meteoric sort of... not rise to success, but it was a meteoric experience. I mean, you ended up playing sessions on Kerrang Radio,
yeah,
and all sorts.
It was about... Well, the week I ended up joining the band, Kerrang dropped them an email and said, look, we're playing your stuff. Would you like to come down and do a session? And which was terrifying. I mean, 6-7 weeks later, I was sat there in the studio next door to Coheed and Cambria, who I sort of was listening to at the time. So that was very, very, very odd.
And you were only, how old would you be then?
I was 17 back then.
So back then. All of 18 months ago.
All of 18 months ago, yeah.
But it was quite a quick sort of introduction to the pop world.
It was a crash course, I think, because obviously living in North Devon, there were bands and things, but they were all very, very close groups of friends. I mean, each band, they all shared members. It was almost like a collective rather than a music scene, which, being at the school that was out of the way of the epicentre, which was Barnstaple, I could never really get in. I mean, I was known about, but obviously at that age, transport's a problem, especially in North Devon. So I never really got involved on that. And it's kind of nice being involved in what's deemed to be a local music scene 4 counties away. Because you can keep completely separate, and if anybody asks, you can actually say, well, actually, I'm not a local. And you gain this complete new layer of enigma. It's great.
Mystery.
It's fun. It's great.
The mystery bass player. Yeah. But, I mean, you know, the actual band members of the Dastards, I mean, you're all spread across the country.
Yeah, well, sadly, our drummer has just left, but he was from he hails from Dunblane in Scotland, and I worked it out once. It would take you, at the time, it would have taken you 26 hours to visit our respective houses.
So
by
the
car.
So the drummer was in Scotland. The singer was
in
London.
Yeah, at the time, and then
the guitarist
was in Stratford, just south of Birmingham.
And you're
in
Bristol.
I was Bristol, Woolacombe, that way, that neck of the woods.
So there, yeah. So it was a commuting band then, really.
Yeah, it's still a bit of a problem in a way. Obviously, we're all a lot closer now. I've moved up to Bristol, which is sort of 2 hours closer to everybody else than I was. So, rehearsals in the evening aren't so much of a problem now.
What's the next performance? Is the next performance going to be with the Dastards, or is it going to be with the North Devon Symphonia?
The next one's with North Devon Symphonia, which is on the something of April, the 18th, I think.
On the 18th of April, okay.
Which we've been rehearsing hard for.
And where's that being played?
That's over in, I think it's in Ilfracombe. It's very bad that I don't know that, but there you go.
And what are the pieces you get?
We're doing a Brahms overture, some Schumann Lieder. We've got one of the Welsh National Opera vocalists coming down to do those with us, which is actually quite scary. And then we're doing Tchaikovsky's fifth symphony, which is hard work.
So that's quite a lot to get through.
It's, yeah, the majority of a day, I think, probably. It's a fair percentage anyway.
It's bring sandwiches to the performance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What do you think you'd like to do in the future? Do you think you'd like to continue this sort of, you know, this creative seesaw between classical and other music?
Well, I've been thinking recently, and I've been reading about how Muse have gone back into the studio, because they're quite a big influence generally. And I can remember the first album of theirs I bought was quite heavily influenced by romantic piano music, which was interesting, and through that it actually opened this world of what was romantic piano music. And they've been maintaining quite a low profile at the moment. They're just sort of releasing the odd video, the odd update sort of thing. And they've said that their new album would probably fit on Classic FM, which has actually annoyed me, because I don't really understand why contemporary popular music and classical music have to be pigeonholed into these separate things. I don't know why they can't sort of get on together, almost. Why do you have to produce an album that's deemed to be classical? It doesn't really make sense.
So what's the, I mean, you know, sort of the boundaries of music, what's the craziest thing you've had to done to do recently?
I don't know, really. The craziest thing I've had to do is probably shuffling a deck of cards in a soundproof room and making that into a piece of music, I suppose. Which, that was quite interesting, looking at how you can actually phrase the shuffling of a deck of cards. And it was hard work,
but somebody had to do it.
Yeah. So it was a good experience, and it was sort of an extension of sort of stuff I've looked into before. I don't think that's the way music is going to go.
No,
I can't see it on radio. One, two, three, or four. That
matter. Card shuffling.
But yeah.
No, you've also done lots of remixes and stuff for people. I mean, you've remixed some stuff for me, which was good fun. And we know which eventually did get released, which was even more fun. So, I mean, do you see that side of it coming together?
Sort of trying to keep my options open at the moment. I mean, obviously, if I wanted to have gone into the classical performance, I'd probably be better off at a conservatoire now, but I'm not. I'm at Bristol University. There's still plenty of time to do the whole band thing. Coldplay were sort of 22, I think. Could be wrong there. But
so do you think being in a band is a young person's game then?
I think you've got to do it. It's something you've got to do, isn't it?
I think so, yes.
Yes.
I think it should be part of the national curriculum.
It's part of a bit of malarkey, you know? That's good fun. Where do I see it going? I quite like to meld all of it together. I don't see why being in a band means you can't be a composer. I think if a lot of people in bands considered themselves to be composers rather than frontmen, I think their music would be considerably better. So I don't see why, in that respect, those can't exist.
Well, you can end up with pieces of music like Tommy by The Who. Which is a bit of a nightmare, but when people start to get a little bit pretentious.
Indulgent, I suppose. Well, I guess the point you're pretentious is when somebody can say that's pretentious. You can't judge whether or not you're being pretentious, I don't think. Because obviously to you, if you're doing it, it seems perfectly reasonable. And you just, it's nice to have somebody there to say, no, that's over the top. Just rein it in a little.
Mm.
But the production thing, these days, definitely knowing about how production works and how things fit together from a sonic perspective is just almost fundamental. I think if it was up to me, I'd probably incorporate it into a composition course, just how sounds in a studio work and why a violin and an oboe sound like they do together, because they are two completely different things, but together they sound incredible.
It was like, you know, if you look back at old recording techniques, look at Stockhausen and all that sort of stuff, where they used to use tape machines, good old-fashioned quarter-inch tape, and they used to, record sort of found sounds or whatever, soundscape sounds, all sorts of things. I mean, the tape recorder actually became an instrument. I mean, in many respects, that things like Pro Tools is, again, another instrument, isn't it? I mean, you can actually make things happen in a recording studio using Pro Tools or Cubase or something that you can't actually do any other way.
I think that's definitely true, but it's sort of almost getting to the point of stagnation where people are thinking, use Pro Tools, once you get it into Pro Tools and then worry about it. And they're not really worrying about what they're putting in. I mean, it's like just throwing all your ingredients into a cake and then trying to form a cake out of this mix, in a way.
A cake mix.
Yeah. Damn, I guess that metaphor. But no, there's intricacies and just little things that people don't really do anymore. Because obviously, when you had these reel-to-reel tapes, if you didn't get the sound you wanted down first time, you had to buy another reel. Or go over it again. And it was an exhaustive resource.
Mm.
And obviously, hard drive space isn't.
Mm.
So nobody really cares whether or not they're getting the right sound.
And also, sort of the digital technology has actually democratised recording, so anybody can do it. You know, so
yes.
In that respect, I mean, there's a lot more recorded music around. There's a lot more stuff that you can download or buy off the internet, or even buy as a CD. I mean, for me, that is actually quite a shame, because there's a lot,
it's very dilute now. There's a lot of
good stuff
amongst the
girls. You have to wade through tons of it.
Well, it's very easy to become dogmatic and snobbish about music now, because obviously anybody with a quarter-inch jack and a headphone socket can produce an album in their bedroom, basically. Which means there is a lot coming out. And obviously the internet's a big thing, and illegal downloading is getting a lot of stick, which in a way, quite rightly so. But I'm almost wondering whether or not it could be beneficial in terms of music as sort of as a creative outlet. I think if you take the money away from music and deny record companies the access to the money they have access to now, and say to them, no, actually we're going to put the people in control of what they listen to by giving them everything for free.
Mm.
And
so what you were talking about is things like Last.fm and all that. Well, you can actually...
even LimeWire and the old Napster thing, where just download whatever you want, don't pay for it, that's fine. I think artistically,
so,
I think that's brilliant.
So who's going to pay you?
Well, this is the thing. I think if the money incentive is taken out, not entirely but slightly, then I think it will filter out quite a lot of the people who aren't doing music for the music.
Mm.
The ones that are doing it for money, the ones that are in it for the glory and the paycheck at the end of the month. I think the ones that really work hard, the ones that probably deserve the credit they don't get a lot of the time, because they don't just go bam, 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 and become next week's big thing.
Mm.
As
I read somewhere that sort of composers, whether it be whatever genre of music they play in, they average out earning less than £10,000 a year.
Yeah, definitely.
Which is, it's impossible to live on £10,000 a year.
No, I know. It's
so musicians have to be paid somehow.
But a lot of that doesn't come from revenue off records.
No, but part of it does, isn't it? I mean, you know, so if it becomes like, if everything is free and you don't get paid for stuff that's being played,
it's not. I don't think that the whole music thing should be free. I just think maybe now it needs reassessing the motives behind selling.
I think it's finished.
Yeah.
I think the whole thing's finished.
I think it has kind of got to the point where it's an inevitable.
I think it's eaten itself.
Yeah. Basically, because the people in the suits at the desk are going to want their paycheck, but obviously the people who want the music aren't giving them that, and are sort of in that sense having control over what the guy in the suit's distributing.
If you look at things like, you know, like Facebook, and you look at MySpace and all those sort of things, I mean, you think, you know, everybody's got like 1,000 friends. I mean, you know, but how many of those 1,000 people actually go and listen to the music or buy the music? I mean, it always seems to me as a strange sort of thing to call these people who are called friends friends.
Right.
I mean, I think it was Warhol said that everybody has 15 minutes of fame.
15 minutes of fame.
But I think it was the CEO of Google or something. I can't remember who it was who came up, but they said
everybody gets 15 minutes at number one.
They get everybody's got 15 friends.
Oh.
You know, so I mean, it's, you know, it's so it is, you know, you can't actually, you know, the music now has gone down this road where you're not really sure what's popular and what isn't.
Well, I guess it's quite strange that alternative music has never really been so popular.
No. I mean, I find it strange that I actually got in the charts 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, I found that odd as well. No, yeah. Sorry. No, I don't know. It's the sort of thing you can theorise and have a guess at what's going to happen. But until somebody comes along and says this is what's going to happen, nobody's really going to know. I'd quite like to be there when it happens.
Well, I hope you will be. I mean, yeah. So, I mean, sort of creatively, then you think the music is still inspiring, even though the actual medium that people will hear your music is probably going to change. You still feel quite content with it all.
I think music is, but not necessarily what's going on now. I think we're stuck in a horrible loop, and I don't see us getting out of it that easily. It's all becoming very, very samey, very manufactured.
Yeah.
Which again, I hope this problem with the record industry is going to solve, yeah, in a way, sort of.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, sort of, I think we'll end on a loop. So I think we'll end in there.
Well, possibly.
Thanks.